They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Again, this is Nate Kaczmarek, director of the Article 1 Initiative. On this episode, we bring you an event from last December with our Charleston, South Carolina lawyers chapter. Their guest was former Congresswoman Sue Myrick, and her wide-ranging remarks cover various congressional reform efforts from former members and other groups, discussion of the current political environment compared to years past, and much more.
This is our chapter's first event in support of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. And for those of you who aren't familiar, you should check it out. It's got its own web presence, web page. It's got its own podcast series as well. And this is kind of an offshoot that Federal Society is doing to try to focus attention on Congress, Congress's traditional role as the first among equals of the branches of government, and attempting to highlight that Congress should reassert itself as the legislative branch where law is made, and so forth. So to speak on that, we have a wonderful speaker. I'm really excited about this. I really am. Sue Myrick, who's a former 9-term member of Congress from North Carolina's 9th District. Sue's story is fantastic. She was a small businesswoman operating an advertising agency in Charlotte in the early 80s, got into a property dispute with the city, decided to run for city council, won. A few years later, decided to run for mayor, won. First female mayor of Charlotte, was mayor during Hurricane Hugo, so kind of tested by fire there. And obviously around here, very similar issues, but was elected to Congress in 1994, the Republican Revolution of 94, and was a liaison to leadership during that transition, and served 18 years. And during her term, she served at different times on the Rules Committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, which I don't think she would say, but I would say are the three most important process legislating and national security committees you could possibly serve on in the House. There's nothing that has the jurisdiction of the Energy and Commerce Committee as far as actually writing bills goes. The Rules Committee sets the rules for the House floor when bills are brought up, and the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence does a lot of great work to keep us all safe. So she has a lot of experience, was in Congress under three presidents, and can speak to how the nature of Congress and its role versus the executive has changed, and we're excited to have her. Sue?
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is very informal, so I mean, I prefer you ask questions. I just went and I brought some articles that I think are pertinent to what we're talking about, some links that I'll just give you the sheet and you can choose to see them or not. But primarily, your timing, the Federalist Society's timing on this couldn't be better because there's a lot of interest finally on this subject. And on the dysfunction of Congress, and you can understand why. And so I think that, you know, the more voices, the more chance it's going to happen that there will be something anyway happen. And so I'm excited about that. And I wanted to tell you first before we, I mean, you ask me whatever you want to ask me, but there's another two efforts going on. There's a group in Washington, which is a nonprofit called Issue One, and that's one of the links that I want to give you. Issue One is a group of people who have decided, you know, that they want to put their money where their mouth is from the standpoint of what they believe. So they have funded this nonprofit to deal with this very issue of how Congress can operate efficiently as far as a country's concerned and do what needs to be done, how the branches can work together. And then the other part of the issue, of course, is what Kevin was talking about, kind of the unequal balance there is between judicial, legislative, and administration now, and how some of that's changed, militarily in particular. So they are very heavily into that issue. I'm going to go on their board in January because it's something I believe in. I started out as a member of a group called the Reformers, and there are over 200 former members of Congress and governors who have decided that they would like to have a voice in trying to bring things back to the way it used to be when it kind of operated right, instead of like it is today with the horrible, I mean, the nastiness, division. It's just, it's an ugly place, and it doesn't have to be that way, you know. But I've always said Congress is the microcosm of America, and so, you know, we're very divided partisan-wise, and there's just a lot of hatred going on. And so the former members, they formed this group called the Reformers Caucus with the sole purpose of trying to bring people into the fold who used to work across party lines when they were there and literally believed in the process of getting something done, just not going up there and, you know, pontificating and, you know, saying I'm mad about this or whatever, but then walking away and not trying to solve the problem. And so the Reformers group is fairly new. It just started last year. We had a meeting in Philadelphia, of course, the way the founding of our country was, not back in March, and just really laid out some of the principles of what we would like to see happen. And that's moving forward. And so as part of that, the people who are the co-chairs of the Reformers group, it's Tim Romer, who was a former congressman from Indiana, who's a wonderful guy, and Zach Womp, who's a former congressman from Tennessee. And so they're the two spearheading this, and they've made a real effort to go onto the Hill, and they started a Reformers Congressional Caucus. And as you probably know, caucuses don't have any authority, you know, and no budgets or anything like that, but it's a way for people of like mind to come together in Congress and work on issues that you care about. And there's all kinds of, I mean, kind of like you name it, there's a caucus. But anyway, and so now I think there are 35 members, totally bipartisan. Everything we're doing is bipartisan. It's not one way or the other. And the idea behind it is for actually coming up with a set of rules, which this Reformers Caucus in Congress has done. And that's one of the links that I'm referring you to, just to get an idea of what they're talking about. But actually making rules changes that will make things work better. And there are a lot of things that can be done that just haven't been done because either leadership doesn't like it or there isn't a real strong initiative to do it. But, you know, I kept telling everybody, I left, well, I'm backtracking, but I left because I was so frustrated. I was banging my head against the wall. I mean, it just felt like I couldn't accomplish anything. And one morning I woke up and I thought, why am I doing this? I have a life. I don't have to do this, you know. And public service is something I got into by the back door, but I really believe in it. I mean, I believe we all have a responsibility to give back to our communities or our country in some way. And so that's the way I always looked at it, was public service. And I got to the point where I felt, I can't help the people at home. You know, I'm not really useful here. And I had never intended to stay as long as I did, but you get going and you start working on issues and all of a sudden, you know, 2 years have passed and that's the way it goes. So I decided to leave voluntarily. And the disturbing part is that this Congress, you know, 53 members of this Congress now are not going to be there in January. And some of them left to run for higher office, but a high percentage of them left because they're sick and tired of exactly what I was sick and tired of. Why am I wasting my time? You know, you can't do anything. And that's pretty disturbing because when people volunteer to run and they truly want to be public servants, they're there for the right reasons. You know, it's not right that there isn't an opportunity for people to function in the way it should. So they're working on the rules packages. The new Congress that goes in, of course, there was a changeover that's been Republican, as you know, it'll be Democrat. So there'll be a change. Who knows what's going to happen with the rules? The Republicans can set their own internal rules. The Democrats set their own internal rules. Like the Republicans have committee chairmanship term limits and have for a lot of years. We were some of the people that forced that because if you don't have term limits, the people who are on committee chairman, they don't want to give up the power. They stay there forever, which is what's happened on the Dem side. And I'm not criticizing one or the other, believe me. So don't, you know, wherever your political views lie, don't worry about, I mean, I'm not being critical. But the Dems have never had the courage as a caucus or a body to put into place chairmanship rules. And now the younger members who are coming in are putting that pressure on. And a lot of them are holding their vote on speaker until they get some of that change, saying it's going to happen, which hasn't happened yet. But it makes a big difference because you have people who can move up the ladder and have a chance of being a chairman if they want to do that. I never did. But if they want to do that, they can move up the ladder. But the way it is, if you don't have any term limits, whoever's in there will stay there for 40 years if they're in Congress 40 years, you know. So I think you'll see some change on the Dem side, too, where you'll have turnover, which is very healthy. But as far as the general rules of the whole Congress is concerned, that's what will be worked out in the rules package that is in process now and will be voted on when Congress goes in the first day that the new Congress convenes. So I have no idea, you know, what will actually be included in that. But it's encouraging to me, as I said when I started, this is time for change. And that's what I've told the Issue One people. I never felt before in my years of being there that there was really any kind of an outside committed effort to help internally to make change happen. And I see that now. And that's what's exciting to me because, you know, the people, if the people get involved, something will happen. And there are a lot of different areas where people are coming forward to say, hey, we want to see this too. So the fact that the Federalists are interested in this, I think you couldn't have had a better year to start to do that. And as I say, I'll give you these sheet of the links so you can check out what you want to on the Issue One and the Reformers Caucus, and then a couple of articles. There was an article in the Washington Post. I'm not a big fan of Washington Post, but I do read to see what they're, and then I get mad and I shouldn't. But anyway, there was an article on the 5th of November, which I provided the link. I didn't print these off because that's like 30-some pages and this is too much. But the subject matter was on exactly what we're talking about and dysfunction and what can be changed and needs to be changed. And it was ProPublica and the Washington Post did it together. And so I think you would find it interesting just simply because of the subject that you're dealing with now, and then some others. And then there was another one in today's post that 44 former senators, and I gave the link to that too. Anyway, it's today's Washington Post, and it says the Senate has long stood for defense of democracy, and it's all about how the legislative branch needs to get involved again. Of course, this is based on basically Yemen, and by the way, the Senate's voting this week whether or not to pull out on our side of Yemen, and because of the Saudi the killing of Khashoggi. So it's interesting and how all that's going to play out. But these senators came forward and said, look, you know, it used to work, and we worked together, Republican and Democrat, and you know, it needs to do that again. So there, and again, that's just another example of, I think, what is brewing internally as well as outside. There's a real issue right now relative to the president and whoever the president is, you know, about what they do in starting going into a skirmish or a country or something. It's not necessarily war at that point because, of course, Congress has the power to declare war. But, you know, the president has, what is it, 90, 100 days? I think I lose track of.
I believe it's 90 under the war power. That's
yeah.
Shorter than me.
90. I think it's 92. They do ignore it, exactly. But, you know, so that's another issue that's coming to the forefront right now because of Yemen. And I think you'll see a lot more of that type of thing. With the president as commander-in-chief, he's in charge of the military, so he has a say-so. But there have been times when Congress has stood up. I mean, the Iran issue with Obama was one. And I made a couple notes because there's sometimes Congress did get involved. In 2017, when Trump wanted to really cut back President Trump, forgive me if I don't say president each time when I'm talking about people. It's not, I don't mean it as a dishonoring the office.
Okay, you were part of a co-equal branch.
When Trump tried to, said he wanted to cut the State Department budget to nothing, you know, and Congress stood up at that point and went ahead and funded our diplomatic efforts, which we've got to have. I mean, you can't just say, no, we're not going to have anybody in the country and we're not going to do diplomacy. It doesn't work. So that was another time that they did. Now, NATO is another example of how they're right now, that business with Trump and NATO and what we do, whether we stay involved and so forth. NATO has served a good purpose for a lot of years. Yeah, there's some problems there. But anyway, so that they stood up there. And I think the basic thing that right now is the main sticking point with Congress and the president is the military powers that the president's office had. But, you know, not long after I was first elected, my husband said to me, you know, something's wrong here. Because the president would do different things. It was a different president then. You know, do different things. And was like, he said, the president's king. He can do anything he wants. And it's kind of like he's taken this power, all of them, through executive orders. You've seen that. And so, you know, some of them do a lot of them. Some of them don't do many. But lately, the executive order part, to override anything that they think they have power to do, has just grown out of proportion, in my opinion. And so I think that's what people are starting to look at. The president has to have freedom and the ability to operate, don't get me wrong, but there are some things that Congress should do that they have ceded to the administrative branch. And then the other challenge you have is when Congress does make laws and says to the bureaucracy within the administration, you have to do X, Y, Z. The bureaucracy knows that people in Congress are there temporarily, and so they say, I'll wait you out. 2 years, you'll be gone. 4 years, whatever it is. And so they really do not implement what the law says, because a lot of people say, well, you know, why don't they make tougher laws that say they have to do this? Well, Congress does do this. But it doesn't happen on the other end. So that's another issue that is a big sticking point. And then the only other thing I'll say is relative to the judicial branch. And in my opinion, the judicial branch legislates too many times instead of just interpreting the law like they're supposed to do. And so right now, there are a lot of issues that I think you'll see coming forward. With this whole discussion of what we're talking about now in the balance of power between the different the three branches, you'll see that be another issue that will come up relative to judicial authority. So with that, I'll stop and ask me anything more.
What would you identify as the major historical reasons for the diminution of the role and power of Congress vis-a-vis particularly the presidency?
I don't know that there is any one particular, in my mind, I'd have to really think about that because I hadn't, but I would say it's more a combination of a lot of issues over the years that have just kind of accumulated and not any one major. I think if it had been something really major, there would have been more of an outcry than you've seen on anything. I don't know. It's a good question because I really had not thought about it before. Yes.
Things like the Gulf of Tonkin.
Pardon?
Things like the Gulf of Tonkin come to mind, situations where there's clearly an emergency emerging where fast action is required.
True.
Congress tolerating and sometimes even supporting the ceding of power to the executive circumstances.
No, that's true. They're in the Bay of Pigs back with Kennedy. Try and think of other ones that have happened. Kuwait, when Saddam went into Kuwait back in, what was it, 1991, that was another one. Right. Yes, sir.
Have you noticed a change over the last few decades where the profile of the type of Congress member has changed in the sense that So, for example, if you entered Congress, say, in the prior generation, you had to not only vote, but you had to work together, and your success was judged by not only re-election, but by the amount of bills you were able to introduce and successfully pass for both your district and for your party. And now, based on who's gotten elected and who's moved on from the House, there tends to be a pattern whereby members feel there's more to win by going on television and speaking out against the leadership and developing their own following rather than passing bills.
Exactly right. There's a difference between a public servant and a politician. And as I said before, a public servant goes to Washington to be a public servant and serve. They don't care about the title. They don't care about the pedestal. They don't care about all this stuff that goes along with it. But a lot of people who are coming to Congress now, their whole goal all their life has been to be a congressman. And that's the wrong reason to go to Congress. Because you want a title and you think you can climb the ladder. And then once they get there, they're looking at what their next step is. Well, am I going to do this to be a committee chairman, or should I run for governor, or should I run for the Senate? And so it's a totally different attitude about why you go to Congress and what your job is and what you should accomplish there. And a lot of it today is go to Congress to stand up, that to represent your district and say no. And it just frustrates the whatever out of me, because nobody gets 100% of the loaf all the time. It does not happen. Our system is built on that dirty word called compromise. And for there's always been problems with compromise way back. Our founding fathers. I mean, you know, you go through all these different periods in history, but I've never seen it like it is today. And some of these guys who are elected, they think they're doing what their district wants by saying no. But, you know, there comes a point where you have to take 80% of the loaf if you can get it and go back and get the next 20% the next time, or 60% and 40 or whatever it is. That's not bad as long as you're heading in the direction that's moving the country where it needs to be. And so that doesn't happen now. The other challenge you've got now is leadership has always been, the word, powerful. No matter who's in leadership, there's power. And it's gotten so, and I guess it's probably always been this way, but I think it's gotten more this way fairly recently, you agree, where it isn't about what you can do for the country if you're in power. It's what you can do for yourself in leadership to be a big deal. And like you say, be on television. You know, some of them are, they're all over television all the time. So the whole reason behind why our founding fathers set up this system for people to come and serve and, you know, go home and be public servants has just gotten totally out of whack. And I'd say the only good thing that's happened from the standpoint of that and the turnover is a lot more younger people are running for Congress, which is very healthy and very good, because you need everybody across the board. You don't just need a bunch of old white guys, which is what it used to be. And so I think there's a real opportunity there that's good for different representation. But when you get that, it makes it more difficult to come together. And so you've got to find those issues that you can work on to move forward. And some of the other stuff may never get done because it is too divisive. I mean, the fight that's going on right now over the word wall, relative to the border. I mean, come on, you know. So, and I support border security, don't get me wrong, but I mean, we just get hung up on these little idiosyncrasies and then nobody will move forward. So that is something that I don't know how you deal with that, because people, well, there's a second part. So let me back up. I forgot a big issue. relative to issue one and the Reformers Caucus, and that is to take the money out of politics. And that was really the initial thing that got the Reformers group going, was those of us who have served in office have seen a tremendous change in what you need to raise, first of all, to run for a seat, and then what comes in from the outside and outside money to what I say can technically buy a seat. And so it always bothered me while I was running, because if you have a lot of money and you run for Congress, you can use your own money. And then after you're elected, you can pay yourself back. And to me, that was wrong, because if a person doesn't have any money and they are a qualified candidate to run, that puts them at a tremendous, tremendous disadvantage. I don't care if somebody puts their own money in, but they shouldn't get it back. I mean, that's their commitment. That's their contribution, you know. So that's always been something that's been kind of a bug with me. But anyway, the Reformers Caucus actually has a set of bills that we're working on. And again, the Reformers Caucus in Congress is working on those. And the idea behind it is to have some kind of transparency whereby all of this dark money, as they call it, you know, if somebody wants to give $10 million, fine, let them give $10 million, but their name should be on it. Somebody should be able to know where the money's coming from, at least. And the way it is now, you have no idea who's putting this money in and who's funding these different groups that have popped up, you know, different types of super PACs and other things. I'm not saying they shouldn't be. I mean, this is America, freedom. You can do what you want to do. But there should not be just this one person putting in $200 billion or something and funding things, and nobody knows who, you know what I mean? It's wrong, because then that's not the way the election system was supposed to operate, in my opinion. And so we're working on trying to get transparency in what they call dark money, change those rules so people can put what they want to in, but at least you know where the money's coming from, and it's not a big secret. So that's a big issue that is well underway within Congress and outside.
Well, I had a question. So you started, when you began, you started talking about the new rules package that comes up every Congress, and we don't know what's going to be in it and so forth. And then also this Reformers group is working on actual legislation. I think there's a question out there of, if members of Congress do decide, if you get agreement that one of the goals of Congress should be to reestablish itself vis-a-vis the presidency, do you think that the best way to do that is by reforming internal rules, or which would make Congress perhaps more effective and pass more bills, therefore the administration wouldn't have as many vacuums to fill? Or do you think that we need targeted legislation that will strip certain things out of the executive branch?
I think it's both. I don't think there's an either or. I think you need all of them.
Great ideas for legislation that would strip.
No, but we've tried to do that before with small things. It was never anything big, but we could take, you know, you can eliminate a bureau or a department or something and take, and you can take money away naturally, and do it that way. I mean, when we came in, we had all these big ideas. We were going to eliminate the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, and HUD. I was in charge of HUD. I mean, you know, we got a long way, because everybody just said, you've got to be kidding me. Well, once we got there and realized that these agencies are humongous and, you know, you're not going to make that change right away, so we did exactly what you're talking about. We targeted certain areas, certain agencies, certain departments within certain bureaus, you know, and we cut those and took the funding away, so that couldn't happen. But it was very small compared to the overall scope of what really goes on. So, but I think it takes all of it, Kevin, mm-hmm. not just one or the other. I mean, you know, my husband used to say all the time, when I go home on weekends, thank goodness you're home. You're not destroying something. You're not building, you know, you're not passing another rule, you know, another law. Sometimes we can get too many of. That's another thing that we've done a lot of in Congress that never gets any notoriety or publicity, is literally taking rules off the books. I mean, well, again, this is a while ago when we were elected, but we started looking at that. And there was a law, literally a law on the books that said that every office had to have, in Congress, had to have a bucket of ice delivered to them every day. This was a holdover before they had refrigeration. I mean, come on. And so, I mean, things like that were just totally asinine. I mean, that's a simple, silly one. But, I mean, there are a lot of them like that that were from the 1800s that pertained to horses and tying your horse up on the street, things like that. They were still in the books for no reason. You know, it's simply because nobody had ever looked at them to say, okay, get rid of that, you know, rescind it. So there have been a lot of rescissions relative to that type of law. I don't know what it makes a whole lot of difference because they weren't being enforced in a lot of cases anyway. But when we got there, they were still bringing us a bucket of ice every day and putting it outside our door. I couldn't believe it. I mean, talk about arcane. Anyway, sorry, I'm regressing. Other questions?
Yes, sir. One other. One way it would seem Congress could increase its power vis-a-vis the bureaucracy, at least, and deal with that. Mm-hmm. Would be to be much more specific with respect to the terms of legislation that passes. The question I have for you is, as a practical matter, is that realistic in view of, one, the amount of sheer work involved in doing that, and two, the extent to which that would argue would make compromise more difficult?
Well, that's right. I think the second part of trying to be more specific in bills when they're passed, it's hard enough to pass a bill the way it is to get agreement. And if you start going down to this nitty-gritty picky points, then that's what people get hung up on. And so you end up just everything falls apart because there's too many little nitty-gritties and you can't get it done. It's a real challenge and there's a real balance there. I mean, that's why there are, you know, 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate, and it's difficult. I certainly don't have all the answers. I just know that if people put their heads together and there's enough support from the people at home, change can happen, and it will happen. But it's got to have support on the outside as well as support on the inside. And, you know, who knows what the next Congress is going to be like. I mean, with all the new people, somebody told me the other day, and I don't know that this is fact because I haven't checked it, but when the new Congress convenes, there are only 30% of the people who will be left who have had any congressional or legislative experience at all. And so all the people who are coming in and the people who have only been there for 2 years, they don't have any what I call institutional knowledge. And I guess that's what bothers me. You know, I supported term limits. We came in and we were going to draw and do term. I supported 6 years, 8 years, 12 years, everything that came down the line I supported, and I would have abided by it. But there's a challenge with too short of term limits, and that is because the bureaucracy we're talking about, people don't have enough time to learn the system to even know how to go around the bureaucracy or who to call or to get things done. I lost my train of thought. I got sidetracked on that.
What do you think about bringing back earmarking?
Earmarks, it's interesting. It's become a dirty word, two words. Earmark, well, I guess it's one word. There's nothing wrong with Congress having a say-so in where money is spent, because that's what they're supposed to do. The challenge that happened is it got completely out of line because the people who got on appropriations because they could channel money back to their district. And so I have no trouble with what you would call an earmark from the standpoint of, I know that we need a road in my district if I'm in Congress, and it's a good legitimate need and cause and all that. If it goes through the authorization process and it's authorized and then the money's dedicated because it's all transparent, fine and dandy. But what happened with earmarks was it started out, you know, that you go through authorization and all, and then they would start earmarking without authorization. They would just say, we're going to spend XYZ over here. And I think one of the most glaring examples was the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska that good old Don Young, I mean, I know him well, but Don's a character. He got, I don't even remember how much it was. It was a huge amount of money to build this bridge, literally, that went over this island where nobody was there. And so, I mean, it stopped. He brought it back again and tried to get it again, but because it got publicity. But that's the kind of thing that made earmarks get a nasty name, because all this crap was put into bills that didn't need to be there. There was no reason for it, and it was just something that made the congressman look good at home. And so that's why we stopped earmarks. But I think if they're done in the right way, where they're authorized, and, you know, you do submit a list of things that your district needs. With me, I always went home and said to my different, you know, governing bodies within the district, what is it that you think you need? And then, of course, we have metropolitan planning, transportation planning, and so whatever was needed for transportation and that kind of thing. And then you submit the list to appropriations if it's and it gets authorized, and then it gets done. Okay, fine. You know, if it's something legit, it's authorized because it goes through several committees to get there. Okay, that makes sense. But when it's just pork, as everybody calls it, it just, it's wrong. I mean, I ran on it, but I literally, when I ran the first time for Congress, I just said, if you want somebody to bring home the bacon, don't send me, because I'm not going to do it. And I meant that sincerely. I just wasn't going to do it. And I turned down a lot of money for our district. And I had an administration. I stood up and fought one of the key people that was chairman of the Transportation Committee. And he had a lot of power. And they were spending money that I didn't think, Steve Largent and myself, and we didn't think that they needed to spend this money. And so we, you know, called them out. And he, of course, got on my case. But then I had an administration official who wanted that particular thing done, too, who came into my office and said, okay, what'll it take? What do you want to vote for this? I said, I don't want anything. You're not going to change my mind. That's not why I'm here. I'm going to do what I think is right, and I'm not going to just, you know, you give me what they were offering was money for my district in exchange for voting for this bill. I said, forget it. And then that happened a second time on an energy issue, too, where the energy secretary came in and said, okay, what do you want? And see, that's what they do. And then the people will say, okay, well, I'm getting something for my district, and so then they'll vote for it, and that's how they pass bills, and that's what they use earmarks for. And so, you know, things get done that don't need to be done. Trade-offs. That's the wrong kind of compromise in my mind.
Thank you, Sue.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.